How often we do it, Nathan, I never get it right. Ecclesiastes chapter 1 will be a portion of where we are today. 1 and 2, technically, will be the majority of our lesson. I want to start with a little bit of making you brush the cobwebs off, if you will. Jim already alluded to that, so we'll just stick with the idea of cobwebs. Going back to grade school and middle school, it's a very important time where you learn a lot about science, you learn a lot about language arts, math. I have to say one of the greatest lessons that I remember from all of my education was a science class in sixth grade. And that particular science class, we studied about the periodic table, we studied about different elements, but I think one of the most influential lessons was the different states of matter, in that if you think about water as an example, how you have a gas form, you have a liquid form, and you have a solid state of water. So ice, vapor, and liquid water. When I thought about that, it just kind of blew my mind, to be honest with you, because when you grow up, you don't really think about the complexities of our world. You don't really think about the complexities of how our world works as a kid. And you reach a point as you become an adult and you grow and you learn and you mature, there's a lot more to our world than we realize. And that lesson was kind of an eye-opening experience for me. In a lot of ways, spiritually, this particular book written by Solomon, David's son, is an eye-opening experience, and it should be spiritually. Because the wisest man to ever walked the earth really pulls back the literary veil, if you will, on a lot of things and a lot of questions that we want answered. And some of them he tries to answer. Some of them he just, in a very eloquently way, says, you're never going to know the answer, so deal with it. What I want to do over the series of a couple of lessons, and we'll do this periodically through the end of the year, is I want to look at some chapters in Ecclesiastes, and I want to take away some lessons that we can and make them practical for our day and age. Because even though this was written centuries before, we are even the glimmer of hope in our mother and father's eye. The beauty of these lessons is they can apply at any stage, at any point, whether you're young or old, and regardless of the century. What I want to do with us this morning is I want to look at this first chapter and the second chapter of Ecclesiastes, and particularly I want you to look at what he says often in Ecclesiastes. In fact, he uses the phrase, vanity is vanity, all is vanity, actually 30 times in the entire book of Ecclesiastes. Sounds like it was something that was very important that he wanted to get across, right? When we read the first chapter of Ecclesiastes, there's a lot that we learn from it, as well as in the second chapter. And so what I want to do is break it up into really four parts this morning to look at what vanity is and how it applies to us and really what Solomon was trying to get across in the first place. If you're taking notes and you want to jot them down, what I want to look at today is, number one, I want to define what vanity is. Number two, we need to look at examples of vanity as he illustrates them. And so what I mean by that is there's really four contexts that he'll define, and I'll label those as we go through this particular lesson. And as you're kind of working through that, the third part of all of this is the application. We have to look at what exactly this brings forth for us, what he's talking about in terms of the vanity of labor, as an example, or the vanity of toil, the vanity of wealth and accomplishments, as we'll look at later on in our lesson today. And as we work through it, I really want you to answer this question, and that is, what is vanity to you in your life? More importantly, what is it that's holding you back from realizing not just what God wants for you in your life, but more importantly, what he wants to do through you? When we look at trying to define vanity, there's a lot of different contexts. And so within the first point of our lesson, trying to define it, you can look up it in a dictionary. You could look up in a lot of different ways. In the dictionary, it is defined in a few different sentences. The quality of being valueless or futile. Feelings of excessive pride. To instill too much value in one's worth. Having no value. Empty. The latter portion, really, in a lot of ways, is a much better definition of the context where the writer Solomon uses the word vanity. The word chabel is, in Ecclesiastes, more or less vapor. So if you were wondering why in the world we were talking about middle school and why we were talking about the periodic tables and the different forms of matter, vapor is something that's a little bit different for us to grasp. And so when I talk about vapor as it pertains to us spiritually or as it pertains to what he's talking about, in a lot of ways when he says vanity of vanities, all is vanity, use the word vapor in the context. He says in the very beginning in verse 2, vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. If you use the word vapor there, what he's really trying to explain is this idea that figuratively, everything that we could obtain in this world, all of the accomplishments, the wealth, the physical things that we could accrue over our time here on earth are just vapor. If you've ever heated up a stove with a boiling pot of water on it, what happens? When you want it to boil, once it reaches that particular temperature that water will boil at, what happens? You get bubbles to the top, but if you allowed that to boil for a period of time, eventually the water would turn to vapor, and the water that was in your pot will disappear because it no longer is a liquid form. It becomes a gas form. Have you ever tried to grab vapor? It's impossible. It's empty. There's nothing there. You can wave your hand over it, and you can see it. If you drove today before the sun really came up or right after it came up, what was across our land? Fog. Kind of a gaseous form of something. When you're looking through your life, what Solomon is trying to drive at is if you don't understand that this life and everything you can obtain in it, all the things that you could desire, if you don't realize that they are empty and meaningless without God, then you have completely missed the boat. When you try to define what this is, I really like the way that James defines it in James chapter 4 and verse 14. James chapter 4, if you want to turn there with me, we can look at a little bit better explanation, I think, as far as this idea of vapor. Let's actually go back up to verse 13. And this is the idea of boasting about tomorrow, boasting about a future. And in a lot of ways, that's what Solomon drives at here, is you can look back on your past, you can look back on your future in these first few chapters, but all of it's meaningless. He says in verse 13, this is James chapter 4, verse 13, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit. Yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and do this or that." In some translations, instead of the word mist, it uses the word vapor. In fact, it's a better use of the etymology of the Greek there. Vapor. Same thing we're talking about here in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. So in defining this, why does Solomon take the time to do that for us? Why does he say, as we read on in the first chapter in verse 3, "What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the generation remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, 'See, this is new'? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things, yet to be among those who come after." There's a lot to unravel in what he's talking about here. But in essence, when we talk about our lives and the things that we can achieve, the things that we can see, the first point being here, the nature of the world, and where we talked about looking at examples of vanity, within that second section, this would be the first point. The vanity of the natural world. There's so much that we can seek to achieve within the natural world. There's so much that we can learn from the natural world. Geology, astronomy, oceanology, anatomy and physiology. Really, in a lot of ways, add whatever ology you want to it, and there's a lot that we can learn from our natural world. But without God, without any meaning, it's all emptiness. There's no really beginning and end. There's nothing to it. When we talk about the natural world, or as in Ecclesiastes, as Solomon tries to illustrate here about the very first point, he kind of does this by looking at different parts of the natural world. He talks about generations and how one generation's impact really is not as significant as we might think it to be in comparison to the earth and the time frame of the earth and all the things that have happened. The idea of nations and how the generations of different nations even have much of an impact. We as man would say, well, of course the Romans had a massive impact on the things that we do. Of course the Greeks, of course the Babylonians, of course the Israelites all had a major impact on the things that we do in this world. But do they really, in the natural world? And the answer would be no, they don't. The things that God sets in order with the natural world, being what he describes here as if the sun rises and it sets, the wind blows, or the way the cycles of the wind work, the way that the sea, all of the rivers and the streams flow to it, yet it's never full. Why? Because of the natural cycles that God had already set in order. When we look at these, one of the things that we have to take away from it as it pertains to this idea of vapor or the desire to achieve things in this world and achieve things as if they are more meaningful as far as just obtaining knowledge about the natural world. Solomon says that they're not. In fact, they're fleeting. They're worthless to you. Matthew Henry explains it in a good way. I want to summarize that for you. He says, we boast of new fashions, new hypotheses, new methods, new expressions, which jostle out the old and put them down. But this is all a mistake. What is there in the kingdom of nature of which we may say this is new? The powers of nature and the links of natural causes are still the same as they were ever. Men's hearts and the corruptions of them are still the same. Their desires, their pursuits, and their complaints are still the same. Does it mean that you shouldn't learn anything about the natural world? Does it mean anything that we shouldn't care about the generations? We shouldn't care about the natural cycles? No. If you look at the beauty of God's creation, Romans 1 explains that it, in essence, explains his majesty. It talks about the beauty of his creation and who he was as a God when he created it. If we don't see, though, that there's meaning in life with God, but there's no meaning in life without God, then we've completely missed the point. The nature of God and being lost in the nature of God, as opposed to being lost in the nature of the world, is a lot of what Solomon is saying here. He says what we need to understand in a lot of ways is that if you're concerned more about the natural world and less about the spiritual or the eternal, then you're not going to have any meaning in life. Paul talks to this in 2 Corinthians 4 and 16 through 18. That's 2 Corinthians 4 and 16 through 18. Paul uses this comparison of the nature of God and being lost in the nature of God and learning more about him and his ways than being more concerned about the nature of our world that we live in. He says, so we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. Vapor is transient. Gas is transient. Vanity is transient, meaning it's going to come and go. God is not. God is eternal. Simply put, if you're caught up in the nature of the world, you're caught up in its beauty and its majesty, without God, you will be disappointed. If you get caught up, though, in the nature of God and His world, you will not be. The second aspect that Solomon drives at in terms of not just the natural world, but this idea of vanity and keeping with it, is this idea of the vanity of wisdom. Is it wrong to learn things? Is it wrong to gain knowledge? No. In fact, there's nothing wrong with having a degree in oceanology, in geology, or as a mechanical engineer, or as a physician. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just, if you desire those things without God, you're going to find that it's meaningless. There are a lot of things that just at the end of our days, you look back on them and think, is this it? Is this all that it was for? I lived for 80 to 90 years and that was it? There's nothing beyond this life? When we talk about the idea of wisdom, read with me still in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. In Ecclesiastes chapter 1, beginning in verse 12, Solomon says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and is striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has done great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know the madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. So let's unpack that a little bit. First of all, when he talks about the idea of wisdom, understand what he means by the term under the sun or under heaven. In a lot of ways, if you look at different contexts in the New Testament, Matthew 12 and 32, Luke 20 and 34, as well as many others, when the phrase like this present age or this age is used, it's referring to this world. It's referring to the physical. It's not referring to the eternal. So when Solomon uses these words to explain how gaining wisdom, gaining knowledge, all these things in a lot of ways are vanity, notice kind of what he explains. He explains that he spent time kind of going through and said, you know what, I'm going to apply my heart, I'm going to seek and find all this knowledge. I'm going to learn everything that I can. And why is it that it's an unhappy business for us in this life? Sometimes it kind of get puzzled by some of the questions that are posed by these writers. It's really explained in Genesis 3 and 17, before Adam and Eve are kicked out of the garden, what is the unhappy business, if you will, that we're posed with as humankind? It is that our life, our work, our toil here on earth, all that we can gain and learn without God and without His statutes and His commandments are vanity. They're nothing. In Genesis 3 and 17, God tells Adam, cursed is the ground for your sake, in toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Both thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat of the herb of the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. I would argue that there's two things that Solomon kind of comes to in terms of a discovery here from this idea of striving after wind, this being kind of an unhappy thing. Well, does God give us unhappy circumstances? Is He the reason that unhappy things happen, or is there something more to it? I would argue with you that what we learn in our toils, what we learn in trying to grow things and trying to learn, is how little we know and how powerful and intelligent God actually is. When we look at the idea of verse 15, what does he say? What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. Crooked in this sense is not wicked or corrupt. I'd explain it in this way. If you look at chapter 7 and verse 13 as an example, he says, consider the work of God, for what can make straight what he made crooked? If God sets one thing in order, in essence, Solomon is saying, you can't turn it back. So what does it have to do with us? Well, when we try to gain knowledge, we try to learn all these things, what does Solomon say they are? It's a striving after wind. So is it pointless for you to want to learn and be educated and want to educate yourself? No. But without God in your life, those things do become meaningless. Why do they become meaningless? Because you have no hope of eternity. You have no hope of the end. You can gain all of the knowledge in the world as Solomon has. And he says at the end of his life, what are the two greatest things? To love God and keep his commandments. That's the very end of Ecclesiastes 12. We'll get to that at another lesson. The complexity of God's knowledge and his wisdom is something that we have to take a step back to realize. And that's what Solomon lays out here for us. As an example, in Job chapters 39 and 40, Job has called out God in a lot of ways after this meaningless conversation that he has for many days with his friends, and it really goes nowhere. And so Job kind of, in a lot of ways, just yells out to God, why is this happening to me? Why are these things going on? And God doesn't answer him. God just talks to him about the behemoth. He talks to him about the Leviathan. He talks to them about all of the great things and the complexities of this earth, some things that Job probably had no idea what he was talking about, to make the point that, Job, it's not for you to know. There's a lot of things that are not for you to know. Is it wrong for you to want to learn? Is it wrong for you to want to grow? Absolutely not. But to understand my ways, to understand my nature, and more importantly, to understand my purpose is the point of your life. To know how to glorify my kingdom and to glorify me in your words and your actions. The same we're seeing is Matthew 10 and 30. That's Matthew 10 and 30. In describing how God's love for us and his understanding of us. Matthew 10 and 30, Jesus explaining this says, but even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Now, for those of you that don't have any hair, you still have hair follicles. They just don't necessarily grow anymore. But God knows every one of them. Is it important for you to have wisdom and knowledge? Yes, it is. But what Solomon's explaining here, I think, is found in the scripture reading that we had, and that is verses 17 and 18. He says, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a striving after wind. Why? Why was it a striving after wind? Why was it for the wisest man in the world a striving after wind to seek knowledge and seek wisdom? For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Why are children so happy? Because they have very little responsibility. They have very little knowledge of what the world actually is. Why is it important for us? What does Jesus say we should be like? The little children. Does it mean you shouldn't grow and mature as an adult? No, not at all. But if in your striving for all the things that you can in your life, you achieve everything that you desired without God in your life, it was meaningless. Because what you'll find is the more knowledge you gain, the older that you get, and the more wisdom you glean, the more foolish you'll think that you are. Because you'll realize how little you know in comparison to God, in comparison to simply what lifetimes would take you to learn. One of the greatest instructors I've ever had, this great physician, he'd been in practice for 50 years and had taught numerous symposiums, numerous discussions on different things, had all of the wealth and the pleasures and accomplishments you would want. And we pulled up to the hospital one day, and he was in this old beat-up Prius. And I thought, you're a cardiothoracic surgeon. You make, you know, close to $1 million a year in what you do with your practice. Why are you driving an old beat-up Prius? And his statement was simple. He just said, Dylan, life is not found in accomplishments or in wealth or in material possessions. It's simply found in God. And he just walked away. I thought, okay. And that statement's always stuck with me for many reasons. I think more than anything, because when you look at you're striving after wisdom, you're striving after knowledge, you're striving for learning the things of this world. Or the next section here in section 2, the idea of self-indulgence, you know, going after your pleasures and your wealth and your accomplishments. At the end of your life, when you look back on it, without a hope of eternity, what was it worth? And secondly, if you do have a hope of eternity, was everything that you did worth it? When he talks in chapter 2 about this third point of the section here, the vanity of our pleasures and our wealth and our accomplishments, read with me in these, because I really think that this should hit home for us. I said in my heart in verse 1 of chapter 2, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. And this is him speaking to himself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man, to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works, I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves, and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there was more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there was more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity, for of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. Some really deep stuff there. In fact, psychologically, I think there were a lot of things that you could argue Solomon was dealing with from a depression, because he realizes so much that's happening and all that he's done, and he's taken so many years of his life to accomplish all these things, accrue all of his wealth. In fact, if you read about the Temple of Solomon, the beauty and its grandeur, there was very few things in the world that could probably ever compare to it. The gold, the silver, just the layout and the architecture alone was impeccable. And yet he looks back on his life and he realizes everything that I did, all the pleasures, all the joys, all the things that I sought after were nothing. Especially in the sense that when I die, I can't take any of it with me. When I die, I have to leave it to somebody else. All of the knowledge that I've gained, I haven't really passed on. All of the wisdom that I've attained, I haven't passed on. And you have to think that of the many, many, many concubines and the many wives that Solomon had, of all of them, the kids that come from it, Rehoboam was the best choice? Really? Rehoboam, the one that, in essence, kind of splits the kingdom and destroys the kingdom, that was the best that the wisest man on earth could bestow upon the next generation of the Israelites. But when Solomon looks back on his life as an old man, as he writes this, in a lot of ways, I would say that's what he's arguing. I've done all these things. Learn from me. Take the lesson from me. All that you could gain, all the accomplishments, all the wealth, all of the things that you could find and desire are nothing without God. When we read in Matthew 16 and 26, this idea of profit and what we can gain from life, Christ says in Matthew 16 and 26, for what shall it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? The idea of laboring, the idea of desiring in this third point, and as we'll close our lesson today, is that you desire, you toil, and you do all these things to reach a conclusion. If you look back on your life, if you've wasted your entire life, what a lot of commentators would argue that Solomon was struggling with is that when we reach a point psychologically, the stages of growth, the stages of maturity, when you reach a point in your life, you look back on your life. And the two kind of disparities are you've given wisdom to the next generation, you've passed that on, that's kind of what you, when you reach that point, that's what you want to do. Or on the flip side of it, the other disparity is that you've wasted your life. You've spent the entire time gaining all this knowledge, doing all these things, or not doing that, and you don't have any more time left. I think when you look at what Solomon is struggling with here is that he withheld nothing from himself and didn't have to. He was the king. He was the most wealthiest king that anyone had seen. And yet he says all of it was empty. It's meaningless. A few lessons and a few questions I would want to have you take away from this lesson tonight. The lesson will be yours, or this morning. Have you ever simply gotten so caught up in the nature of the world and the nature of learning the things of the natural world that you've kind of lost your place? You get caught up more in its beauties and its wonder, and so you don't have enough time for God. We don't see that as much in the Bible Belt as you do in the Northwest and in the areas where we actually live in the midst, within mountains, you live near the ocean. But it happens. We get caught up in the things of this world, in the natural world, its beauty and its wonder. But what you have to realize is that without God, it's all meaningless. Have you ever been caught up in the wisdom of man? You can spend your time getting so caught up in the things of this world that man has. And are they worthwhile? Yes, absolutely. But they're nothing more in comparison to what God can offer to us. And Solomon, in describing the conclusion to all of this, is that he says in verse 18 of chapter 2, I hated all my toil in which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. The two things I would have you take away from this would be, is God saying that, and Solomon saying that in all of his wisdom, that in the years that he spent enjoying his time here on this earth, should we not enjoy our time here on earth? And the answer would be no. That's not what he's saying at all. He's saying that the time that you spend working, the time that you spend doing these things, enjoy that time that you have. Don't wish away the kids' years where they're sick all the time and they're tired and you're up late at night. Don't wish away the time that you're hoping to get to the next promotion, to the finishing of your degree. Whatever it may be, don't wish away the time and the toil that it takes, because the enjoyment is not just the destination. It's just as much the journey. In fact, I would argue that the journey is far more wonderful. Because when we come to know God and we come to know eternity and we come to know Him and that new world that we find in Him when we are with Him in heaven, will be so wonderful if that's what we've been striving to accomplish. And as we strive for these things, the one thing that you have to look back on your life is, what have you done with it? Are you like Solomon and you look back on your life and the best that you can hope for is that your son that's going to inherit everything, that's going to take over, hopefully won't mess it all up. All the work that you've put in, all the time that you put in, the inheritance that he takes, that he won't mess it up. Or have you spent that time training and teaching the next generation so that they might be even more successful than you were? More importantly, more successful with the kingdom and their knowledge of the kingdom than you were. Because that's what we're striving for, isn't it? For us to have a hope in eternity, and not just for us to have a hope, but for our children and our children's children. Because we have two options. We can end up like the Israelites, to where the next generation, the generation after that, don't know anything about God. Or we can strive to ensure that we have done everything in our power, that this church, that our families, that our friends and our lives are where they should be with God. That everything that we've done, everything that we've striven for is not vapor. It's not vanity. It wasn't empty. Because it wasn't about this world. It was about the next. It was about God. If you're not a Christian this morning, this was not a lesson about salvation. This was a lesson more and less about how we as Christians can mature and grow to know God and the things that he wants of us. But I can assure you that hope that you want in heaven, Romans chapter 6 tells us that when we die to sin and we are buried with Christ in baptism and come up into a newness of life, that sin, that old chain that was bound to you and holding you back from who God wants you to be can be released, and you can be pure and right before him. And if you haven't been living righteously, you need to make your confession known publicly. Make that next step while we stand and while we sing.